You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today, despite the technological struggles of my computer. My computer decided to blow up just as our producer, Danny, called. So Skype just like suddenly shut down, and then it turned out that the phone was like being weird, and so I couldn't call in. And then Skype decided to work again. So here I am. And we are now in the throes of getting Mr. Rod Bennett on the air as well. I'm not sure if he's here or not yet. Are you there, Rod? Rod is not there. So we will soon have Rod Bennett on the air. Oh, and here he is. How you doing, man? Hello.
How you doing?
Oh, pretty good. So Danny calls me, you know, a couple minutes to air, like always, and Skype just like suddenly just blew up and disappeared off of my screen. And
we'll get so by.
I tried to restart it and it wouldn't restart. And so I thought, well, maybe I got to reboot my computer. So I tried to shut down like everything on my computer and none of that would work either. And
well, Luddite that I am, let me step in for a moment to remind you that the Alexander Graham Bell method that I'm using works really good.
Yeah. I'm a big believer in percussive maintenance myself. If things don't work,
that's right.
Just hit the machine really hard and see what happens there.
Are we on the air?
We are indeed on the air, yes.
Although I don't know that we're actually on the air. I think this is all going out via computers, am I right?
You just have to trust and believe. That's what I
say.
On
the air is one of those terms like dialing the phone, right? Even though none of them have dials anymore.
None of them have dials anymore. It's like Kleenex means all tissue paper, which is, by the way, a great boon for the Kleenex company. Because no matter what tissue paper you're using, everybody calls it Kleenex. And so Kleenex gets free advertising from all of its competitors.
Xerox copies had a nice run.
Yeah, Xerox is the same
piggyback
way.
Also.
Yep.
But it's over now. So I used Xerox copy as an analogy in apostasy that wasn't. And it only occurred to me a little later that probably my younger readers know what a Xerox copy was.
I know what a Xerox is. Yeah. Yeah, that's how it goes. So it was hilarious. So I thought, okay, obviously the computer's not going to cooperate. So I tried to call in. And it turned out that somewhere in our house, one of our phones was like still on. And so there was no dial tone, so I couldn't. There's no way I could get a hold of Danny to even tell him that the computer wasn't working. So then I went back and looked at my computer, and mysteriously Skype had restarted.
How about that?
And Danny was calling me, and so I picked up the phone, and it was like already after airtime. And I thought, you know, I have patient listeners who just believe that things will be all right.
Well, this better be good now that we've
it's got to be
moved heaven and earth to get a show on.
To get a show on the air. Well, you know, I heard from one of my listeners who was greatly disappointed at the news that I'm about to give you.
Okay.
Which is that I've been giving each of my I'm giving my listeners and I'm also giving my co-hosts. So I just discovered on Monday that what Breadbox Media has decided to do is go completely to a podcast platform. So as of this Friday, we will not be streaming live over the web anymore. And so what is happening is this show will continue, but it's going to continue as a podcast, and it's going to be a once-a-week podcast. So they're doing this with apparently with all the shows on Breadbox Media. So what that means is I will still have you on the show now and then, but since it's only a once-a-week show, I'm sort of parsing I'll be parsing things out to, among other things, to share the show with co-hosts and also to have guests on and so forth. But since you're always so fun to talk to, you are definitely going to be one of the people
I'd love to have on the show. I've been fired out of better gigs than this.
Okay, yeah. Well, you're not really fired. You're just... you know, you're going to make the same fabulous sums of money that you always have.
That I can believe.
You have been paid, and this is absolutely true, you have made exactly the same amount of money off the show as I have.
How about
and,
that?
I'm told... that I might even wind up getting some moolah off the show now. So
remuneration.
If that happens and you're on the show, then you will make half that moolah for that episode. So
all right, I don't care anything about money. I got
okay. Well, that's good because it's not going to be a lot of moolah. I can tell you that. You know, I actually had somebody tell me the other day on Facebook that the FBI needs to investigate my finances.
Yeah, the great haul that you're pulling in this Catholic apologetics racket.
This is why I do what I do. Apparently my funding comes from extremely shady sources.
George Soros was mentioned, I'm sure.
You're darn tootin', yes. All that Soros money, it certainly is.
I think the Soros thing and the Koch brothers thing should cancel each other out. They never do for some reason.
Yeah. That whole thing, you know, that it's like the belief that, you know, the Skull and Bones Club and the Trilateral Commission and the Bilderbergers, whatever the build. You know, when I hear Bilderberger, all I can think of is like some kind of restaurant chain.
Well, there's Whataburger, so I don't know if they control the world, but.
Yeah, but Bilderbergers, I think Bilderbergers are like do-it-yourself burgers that you build yourself, but. Instead of using hamburger buns, you use bagels because that makes it more Jewish and sinister that way.
Yeah, so, I guess so. Whenever somebody mentions either Coke or Soros, I quickly suggest that we load all three of them onto the next NASA Pluto Express and get shot of them for good. And for some reason, that my correspondents don't go for this.
Yeah.
It's left wing or right wing, you pick, money in politics that they don't like.
Right.
Not money
and
in
it's
politics.
It's controlling everything.
I digress. Although I don't know that I do. Do we have a subject to digress from?
That is so rare on this show. You know, when I talk to you, digression, how often does that happen? One of the things that has always interested me is this by the way goes back to the really insightful work of a French philosopher named René Girard. René Girard, who was raised Catholic and left the church, became an atheist, but eventually came back to the church because his work in philosophy. Led him to discover what I think is really tremendously insightful is a really deep structure of human social behavior, which is the need for a scapegoat, the need for scapegoating violence, that when a society feels itself to be in peril, what it always does is it finds somebody that it can declare to be the boogeyman.
Yeah, outside the pale.
Yeah, someone who can be exiled from good society, and then the sins of the community, the faults of the community, the troubles of the community are placed on that scapegoat's head, and then that scapegoat is subjected to violence. And this is a pattern that happens over and over and over again throughout human history. People do this. And we're doing it now. You know, we're doing it here in the United States. We'll talk about that more when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. And we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Rod Bennett. Rod Bennett, writer, author, raconteur, which is a great word, by the way, raconteur. Raconteur is the kind of word that you apply to your chatty uncle who has cool stories about his time in Africa and, you know, stuff like that. And, you know, was a terrific raconteur. I heard him once. John Rhys Davies, the guy that played.
I can believe that.
That guy, he is your favorite uncle. He's the guy that, you know, shows up at your house every 10 years, and he's got all these awesome stories about his adventures, and you get your drink at your elbow, and you pull the chair up by the fire, and you invite all of your friends and neighbors over, because this guy is just going to expound for a few hours on all the cool things that he's done.
That sounds great.
Yeah, he was great. He came here to Seattle about, I don't know, it was around the time The Lord of the Rings was out, so maybe like 15 years ago. And I went with my sons. Luke has a picture of him, like, getting something signed by John Rhys Davies and standing behind him, you know, with the happy thumbs up and stuff.
For those who may be a little less geeky than we are, John Rhys Davies plays Gimli the Dwarf in the Lord of the Rings films.
That's right. And Sala.
Also, Indiana Jones' sidekick, yes. Sala.
That's right, yeah. And
he's the guy that had that immortal line, asps, very dangerous. You go first.
Yes, exactly. Yep, so anyway, he was super interesting, but I don't know how we got onto that. Well, I know what we were talking about. We were talking, before the break, we were talking about René Girard. And René Girard was a French philosopher, I think one of the most important philosophers of the 20th century. And what he began to notice was this curious and very deep structure that is present everywhere in the human race. This is a deep feature of human social behavior, and not something that's going to be eradicated, I think, ever. And it's this impulse of human aggregates to deal with their problems by fixing on a scapegoat and visiting violence on that scapegoat as a way of dealing with their problems. Sometimes it's seen as atoning for their sins. Sometimes it's seen as, stamping out the enemy within. Purging the evil from among us. But this is something that human beings have done throughout their history. And it doesn't go away with modernity. It was what we saw in the Holocaust. It takes various forms, and the kind of violence that happens can be different kinds of violence. It doesn't always involve killing, but it does always involve finding this scapegoat. And typically the scapegoat is someone who is from within, who is perceived originally as in some way within the community. And then the community sort of coalesces. The community draws apart from the perceived enemy within and isolates that perceived
rejects
enemy.
Rejects the infection, the
right,
virus.
Rejects the perceived infection and then attacks it in some way. So sometimes the attack takes the form of imprisonment, or it can take the form of expulsion from the community. So they have to leave and go somewhere else. And sometimes it takes the form of murder. And what René Girard saw was that one religious tradition was founded on the unique idea that God himself chose to become that scapegoat. That God enters into the community, becomes part of the community, the human family, and then himself undergoes this process of rejection and mimetic violence and being killed for the sin of the community. And that really struck Girard as profound, that this is the story that's right at the heart of the Christian tradition, is that God himself took that place of the rejected other, allows all of this
term scapegoat comes from the Old Testament, from the prehistory of Christianity.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
It flowered out. Myth became fact in the person of Jesus, but it had been part of the Judeo-Christian story all along.
Yeah, and this has been part of the place of the Christian in the world. At his best. Now, Christians, of course, have also done this. Most notably, Christian history is littered with this kind of mimetic violence visited on Jews, in particular. And it's one of the great primal sins of the Christian tradition that there have been Christians, and not a few, who have themselves chosen to be the scapegoaters, who have done to others what was done to Jesus. So merely being a Christian doesn't mean that you're immune from this temptation, or that you're immune from, the church is immune from having done this itself. But that doesn't alter the fact of who Jesus is. And this is what Girard saw. And so Girard eventually returns to the faith because of that, because he sees he doesn't make the mistake of saying, wow, Christians never do this. What he sees is Jesus, and that Jesus volunteers.
Well, let's say you're God and you love these people who do this nasty thing.
Mm-hmm.
What do you do? You've got to get that out of them somehow. You've got to root that out.
Right.
And it may not be easy as it sounds, even for God. Maybe he may have had to take extreme measures, and thus the story of the incarnation.
Right. And so what Girard sees is that Christianity not is immune to this, but that Christianity alone of all the religious traditions of the world offers precisely a God who says, if you'll trust me, I will help you get past this. But
how about this? If you must have a scapegoat, and apparently you must, then let me be the scapegoat.
Let me be that scapegoat.
Because I'm kind of the only person big enough to take it.
Right. And this is what Bishop Barron, Robert Barron, has talked about this. He's I've seen a number of videos that he's done where he's talked about Girard and this this phenomenon of what Girard called mimetic violence. And he says that's, you know, that's really what the story of, particularly of the passion of Jesus is about, is that Jesus deliberately allows every form of human dysfunction and violence to wash over him, and it overwhelms him. It kills him. This is, you know, that's part of the strangeness of the story, is that we don't have a kind of Herculean figure who says, do your worst and I will withstand it all. What he says right. is do your worst and it will kill me. Like it, the way I heard it put the other day, I thought this was very perceptive, that that God became man. God did not become Superman.
There we go.
And so Jesus has all the weaknesses that we do. He gets tired. If you cut him, he bleeds. If you, you know, drive spikes through his hands and feet, he dies. Because that's what happens to human beings. He's not Superman. He's just man. And yet, of course, in the resurrection, God does triumph over this. And so there is at last a way out of this, what seems to be this kind of unavoidable karmic doom of the human race to always act this horrible way. What the resurrection says is, no, there is a way past this, and God will give you the grace to do that. But, of course, you have to cooperate with that grace.
You short-circuit, he short-circuits the normal process. For readers of C.S. Lewis's Narnia, there's a deeper magic from beyond the dawn, from before the dawn of time. In other words, he can sort of take on an unexpected role. Who would have believed that that God, safe in his heaven, would make himself vulnerable enough so that he could be killed by one particular little species on one particular little globe? And it's an unexpected story, but it does take on new significance if you think about it in terms of short-circuiting this this need for the scapegoat.
It gives me hope, you know, because we are really talking about extremely deep structures in the human race, and very broken ones that are hard to get past. We'll continue this conversation when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett, and we'll be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.
Connecting Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett.
And hey, Mark, I had a thought that maybe an offshoot from the Girard stuff, the scapegoat.
Hit me.
Another recurring theme in our society that crops up from time to time, and may very well be the same thing in a slightly different form, is that almost every society finds historically that in order to function, they need to pick some group whose rights don't matter as much as everybody else's.
Right.
In other words, they have to pick somebody to take up the slack.
Right.
In other words, to absorb the shock, if you see what I'm saying.
Yep.
In the, of course, in the, before the Civil War, the person whose rights didn't matter was the black man.
Right.
And, you know, there were all kinds of reasons why his rights didn't matter as much. You know, there was all kinds of theories. Hardly anybody said he had no rights at all, that it was okay to do whatever you wanted to him. But they all had various scientific reasons or religious reasons or whatever reasons why it was okay that he had to absorb a lot of the slack for the rest of why he had to be, you know, one of the ways that it was commonly put was, you know, in every society you've got to have hewers of wood and drawers of water. And so if there's servile work to be done in the society, then, you know, God has supplied servile creatures to do the work, you know.
Right.
So there's always various, and some of it was evolutionary as you went on, the theories of Darwin and all the rest of it got incorporated into it, or there were various weird biblical arguments and all the rest of it. But the bottom line was, this is a group of people who it's okay that they're being treated this way because their rights don't actually matter as much as other people's do.
Right. Native Americans also, of course, got that.
Yeah, that's right. Whenever somebody is in the way, you know, you can say, well, they're savages, or you can say they're heathen in the sense that they believe a false religion or whatever. There's always some reason why they don't get big a bowl of soup as everybody else, and it's okay that they don't.
Right.
And,
and
now
that's part of that
the person who has this role in today's society is children. The abortion was probably the first and most spectacular example of this. And I think part of that was because I don't think it's a coincidence that the Roe decision and, you know, the larger mainstreaming of abortion that was going on at that time. I don't think it's a coincidence that it was connected with the big scare about the population bomb and all the rest of it that was happening right about then, 1971, 72.
Well, that reminds me, actually.
Overpopulation was literally linked to the bomb, to atomic annihilation. Population was going to do it just as well.
Yeah.
So, you know, people shouldn't have so many children, and there's too many children, and children are the problem, and children are the reason the forests are being cut down and all the rest of it, and there's too many. So maybe it's okay that there be fewer of them.
Yeah.
If you see what I'm driving at.
Oh, well, you're familiar with Bill Nye, right?
Yeah.
Bill Nye, the science guy. Now, Bill Nye comes from Seattle. He's he was a neighbor. He used to be on a show here back in the 80s called Almost Live. And he got his start. He was an engineer at Boeing. And he got his start doing stand-up comedy here in Seattle, and then moved into he started doing Almost Live, and then he got this gig doing science stuff because, you know, he was an engineer, so he understood, you know, a lot of sciencey things. So he became this science popularizer. Well, he's got a new show on Netflix, and unfortunately, and this happens with science popularizers, it you know, Neil deGrasse Tyson does this stuff. Carl
Sagan
can't
resist leaving subjects that they do know something about and going into subjects about which they're complete rank amateurs.
Yes, yes. Stephen Hawking has done the same thing. You know, when these guys start getting full of metaphysics and philosophy and theology, it's always a catastrophe because they don't know what they're talking about. So Bill Nye, you know, on his show just recently, was asking exactly the same question that was put forward by Francis Galton in the late 19th century. Do people need to be licensed, or rather, do people need to be penalized by the state for having, quote, extra children, unquote?
Yes.
And this is, you know, this is Scrooge's theory of population, right? If the poor be like to die, they better do it and help decrease the surplus population. And this whole notion of extra children, the people who talk about this, like Nye, never, of course, stop and wonder if maybe they're the extras who need to be
eliminated. This was Chesterton's famous quote on the subject.
Yeah.
People who talk about the surplus population should be asked if they are the surplus population, and if not, how do they know?
Yeah, exactly right. And so this notion that there are people out there who need to apply for a license with the state to have children, because maybe they're not the right sort because perhaps you carry a gene for something or other.
Yeah.
So maybe you shouldn't be allowed
to have eugenics, which at least didn't may if it didn't die, at least expired ignominiously in the 1950s.
Yeah. Well, it died in the 1940s, between about 1942 and 1945.
There was still some of it lingering in some places. I stretched it a little further just because there were...
But you're right. The thinking that led to Auschwitz was precisely the idea that there are people who are fit to have children, that there are people who are fit to live, and those who are not fit to live.
Right.
What are we going to do about those who are not fit to live? Well, you know, the gentle way to approach that problem is to start saying things like people should be licensed to have children.
Right.
They should be legally punished if they have too many children. The brutal way, which the Germans carried out, was who cares if you happen to have been lucky enough to have been born? We've decided that you're unfit.
Right.
So we're going to get rid of
And they
of
started
this.
With a program of mercy killing.
Exactly.
In
right.
the early 30s, they started with a program of supposed mercy killing,
right.
Euthanizing what they called useless eaters. The terms of who was a useless eater got gradually expanded to include all of the Jews.
Right.
So
undesirables.
Enough said on the idea that some people's rights don't matter as much as others. And the eugenics movement definitely puts the onus of this on unwanted children. So we're going to prevent their... In fact, even if you read the opinion, the Roe opinion, the people who voted in favor of it, Blackmun and all the rest of them, the original opinion is very interesting to read because it says... it's rather an embarrassment to read the document now because all through they're saying, well, we can't believe that this is going to be common beyond the first trimester. So, that's not going to be a problem. So this is all that talk about the first, second, third trimesters is, it's all throughout the document that they can't believe that it would ever go beyond that. But also in there is the idea that it's going to put an end to unwanted children. And, it's very utopian. They make their dreams for the new decision very plain. And, it's actually going to be a good thing so that there's fewer of these useless eaters, unwanted children.
Okay.
And, of course, all of this, again, in the context of the population bomb, the big population scare, Malthusian population scare of that era, which was, of course, grotesquely overstated. So, but anyway, the larger point I'm trying to get at here is that when you pick a group of people like that whose rights don't matter as much, that they get to be the shock absorbers for all the rest of us, here's what I mean by that. The Roe decision... and other decisions, no-fault divorce and all the rest of it, all of the anti-family decisions of the 1970s and 80s, the one idea behind all of that is that the individual adult's right to his own version of what he thinks will be sexual happiness trumps any right that the child could have.
Right.
The right to grow up in a stable home, the right to have both his parents around, all of those things, the idea of a stable marriage laws that protect his environment, all the rest of it. The right to the adult's right to sexual happiness as he understands it trumps all of it.
Yeah.
And eventually trumps even the right to life.
Yeah.
In other words, if the child is simply not wanted, that's a death sentence. Or a death sentence if the parent so chooses.
Right.
So this guy, I don't know exactly how it's connected to what we were talking about with Girard, but I think it must be.
Well, it is. It's the same idea. It's the idea that there is a pecking order and that the problems of any given society can be shuffled down to the bottom of the food chain.
Yeah, and you can disguise it, too. It was Orwell pointed it out pretty well with his famous line, all animals are created equal, but some animals are more equal.
More equal than others. Exactly right. We are up against a break, but we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back with Mr. Rod Bennett here on Breadbox Media right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Mr. Rod Bennett. Rod is the author of such fine books as The Christus Experiment and The Apostasy That Wasn't and Four Witnesses, which for some reason, I always when I hear Four Witnesses, it always makes me think of The Four Feathers, which is a novel that meant a huge amount to somebody who's near and dear to both of us, Marion C. Cooper.
Ah, and he made a movie of it, if I'm remembering right.
Yes,
Well, A Late Silent came out about 1929, something like that.
He read it
the more famous version is the British version from 1939 in Technicolor, and it's really good, too.
Okay.
And then there was a recent one, I think, with modern, hunky modern stars. So
I think you're right, yeah. Right. He was being held prisoner by the Soviets after fighting on behalf of the Poles. And he read The Four Feathers several times while he was being held prisoner by the Soviets in his incredibly amazing life. That's just one thing that happened to him. He also escaped from the Soviets by, among other things, murdering a guard. And then managed to get across the border back to Poland, where he was feted by the Poles and thanked for his all of his efforts, for which he refused to take any money. So they booked him passage back to the United States. And when he got back, he had $2 in his pocket, and he gave one to a hobo and, you know, like, bought a suit with the other one. This guy is a gallant hero, you know?
Yeah, it's quite a story.
Went on to make King Kong, among other things.
The title of his biography is I'm King Kong.
That's right. That's right. Marion C. Cooper is just an amazing guy.
Yeah, he is. Yeah. Yeah.
Shot down in World War One, where he went to fight in World War One, before the U.S. was at war, because he wanted to fly airplanes. That's how he got kicked out of Annapolis, because he said airplanes are the wave of the future. And, you know, you can bomb ships from airplanes. So the Navy should really think about that. Yeah, and the Navy responded by saying, shut up.
In those days. Well, I mean, it did kind of say everything you're doing is misguided because it's based on outmoded conditions.
Yep. Which, you know, World War One would prove
people
again.
People don't take to that too easily.
They don't like to hear new things. You know, well, that's another, you know, consistent feature of the human race is the human race doesn't want to think in a new way.
Changes are not usually welcome.
Yeah. The guy that says think differently is always the guy that people hate right up until the time he's vindicated. I wonder what Marion C. Cooper thought of the court-martial of Billy Mitchell. He must have thought that was just ridiculous.
Yeah, I think I've read something about that, but I would hesitate to try to say what it was at this point. Because
if you want to see a good movie, if you remember, it's an old movie, came out in the '50s. Watch The Court Martial of Billy Mitchell. Billy Mitchell was another advocate of air power, and he was put on trial in the '20s for saying, you know, air power's the wave of the future, and he was condemned as insubordinate. And so they put him on trial. And in the course of the trial, he said, there's going to come a day when the Empire of Japan is going to attack our naval station at Pearl Harbor, and that attack is going to come on a Sunday morning.
Pretty good.
And everybody said, you're crazy, right? And he was one of those guys that wound up being dramatically vindicated.
Yep, I guess so.
But
yeah, if you ever now, this is a real curio. A movie made by Walt Disney called Victory Through Air Power came out in 1943, I believe.
Okay.
Walt made mainly wartime films during the war. He turned almost the whole studio over to the use of the armed forces and made training films and, lost a lot of money, but turned the whole studio over for that purpose. But one of the things he did was he made a movie advocating a certain set of theories about air power, very similar to Billy Mitchell's ideas, that still hadn't been accepted in the middle of World War II. And so Walt made a whole feature film called Victory Through Air, an animated film called Victory Through Air Power that's almost never seen anymore. But okay. It's a really fascinating curio.
Okay. I've heard the title, but I don't think I've ever seen it.
It's hard to see. It was released as part of a DVD set for collectors a few years back.
I wonder if it's on YouTube.
That's a possibility. Yeah, look it up. Victory Through Air Power.
Victory Through Air Power. Okay. Yeah. but the Marion C. Cooper is one of those guys who just managed to live this epic life. He just he wound up doing all these things. And he's one of these guys that partly it was luck, but he was in a lot of ways, he was a guy who made his own luck.
Well, he was kind of the classic.
He made things happen.
Little short guy that had to prove himself because he was a little under height.
Yeah,
he wasn't really short, but he was a shortish guy.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times, a guy like that really overcompensates.
Well, I gotta say, he's just one of these guys who, I keep thinking someone should make a story of the life of Marion C. Cooper because it's so epic that it's hard to believe that one guy did all these things.
Yep, and helped to invent Cinerama. He watched Dream Movies, in other words.
Okay.
He did all kinds of things.
Quiet Man, and he made a bunch of John Ford movies. He was like a producer.
You'll see his name on stuff like She Wore a Yellow Ribbon and Fort Apache, things like that. Yeah, he's got his name on some of the – he's a great, great movie producer.
Did he push for Technicolor?
The great classics.
Was he one of the guys that pushed for Technicolor as well?
Well, in the 50s, everybody was afraid that television was going to make movies obsolete,
Mm-hmm.
Why go to the trouble of getting dressed? And, of course, nowadays we don't. In those days, you'd get dressed up, which meant a coat and tie for most men. And you'd go to a big downtown theater, and it was more like going to the opera or something than it was what we do,
Yeah.
I'm just barely old enough to remember this, going to the big downtown Fox Theater in Atlanta to see Mary Poppins in 1964. In those days, people dressed up. It was a night on the town to go out to the big movie palace.
It wasn't
24 theaters in one strip. This is one big theater. It seats 5,800 people.
Wow. That would have been cool.
But yes, in the 50s, everybody was afraid that people had television now, so why go out to the movies? And so that's when they started saying, well, we've got to do something to make what we're doing different. So that's when color became more important than it had been, and widescreen and stereo sound and all the rest of it.
I remember when I was a kid, one of the great traumas of my life as a child was because going to the movies was an incredibly rare experience when I was growing up. The idea of walking into a theater and actually seeing something on a big screen was super thrilling to me because it almost never happened. And my dad came home one day and said, guess what, kids, we're going to go. By that, he meant really me, because my older brothers are 9 and 12 years older than me. But we're going to go see The Sword in the Stone. And I was so thrilled because we're going to go to an
something like
actual
that
movie. 64, 65, I think.
Oh, I don't think it's that late.
Yeah, because it was. So anyway, we went off to the theater, and the theater was sold out.
Oh no!
And so we didn't get to see The Sword in the Stone, and this was like a trauma that like stuck with me for years. I remember that
soured your whole outlook on life.
You know, and I never got to see The Sword in the Stone in the theater. It was just such a crushing. And the thing is like the next time I went to a movie in a theater was probably like years later, because we really just never went to the movies.
Oh goodness!
But yeah, I remember that. That was a big deal, going to see a movie. Yeah,
it sure was.
So I still get, you know, that a little thrill when I get to go into a movie theater and see something on a big screen, you know. So it's just it's just one of those
great
things.
little souvenir of that era in the Petula Clark song about downtown. You remember downtown?
Yeah.
Don't be blue, go downtown where there are movie shows. So and there were. That's what you did in those days. You didn't have mall theaters because you didn't have the malls. So,
well, I think movies helped people survive the Depression and World War II.
Right. Yeah.
You know?
Well, some of them literally. There was 24-hour theaters that homeless people slept in.
Really? I did not know that.
So long as they didn't get too disruptive, they could sit in the back row and stay for a long time. They didn't throw you out of movies in those days the way they do now. You bought a ticket. Huh. There weren't really any start times.
Okay.
A lot of people don't realize that. The first movie that started our modern trend of publishing the start time in the paper so that people wouldn't come in part of the way through was Psycho in 1960.
Really?
Before that, you bought they had what were called continuous showings. So you bought a ticket, say 35 cents. You walked into the theater. It may be that the main feature was halfway through, almost finished, just getting started. But after it was over, there were shorts, cartoons, Three Stooges, newsreels, all the rest of it. And then they sometimes started another feature different than the one you came in on. And then there were more shorts and cartoons. And then finally got back around to the main feature that you came to see. And a lot of people would stay up to the point where they walked in and then leave.
Okay.
So it's a really different way of doing it than we do now. But because
really
of that, nobody was monitoring how long you stayed in the theater. So people literally stayed out of a sub-zero night by buying a ticket to the movies.
See, it's knowledge of this kind of arcana, which is why I
why you keep me around, right?
It's why I've paid you so well, you know, for doing this show. Well, Rod, I want to thank you so much for being on the show today. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Danny Head, and we will be back tomorrow with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Until then, have a great evening. Bye-bye.
Bye, everybody.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcasts. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app. Change the world.